Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, a member of the club's Health and Medicine Forum and the Environment and Natural Resources Forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience and invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. The Commonwealth Club thrives on the ideas and involvement of its members. When over a year ago Camilla Reese suggested tonight's topic, I have to admit that I wasn't aware as I am now of the great volume of science documenting the biological effects of wireless technologies. I read the landmark Bioinitiative report at her suggestion, a review of the science on this topic prepared by 16 leading international scientists, and met with one of its contributors, Dr. Ole Johansson, at the Karolinska Institute in Sweden. I also read the scientific report sent to the city of San Francisco last year, warning of the potential health consequences of citywide Wi-Fi. I continue to read on this topic, joining the Collaborative for Health and Environment's EMF Working Group, an affiliation of scientists globally eagerly sharing studies and developments on this topic worldwide. There is no doubt in my mind at this point that electromagnetic frequencies are triggering serious health effects consequences globally, and that it is something that needs our attention. When the Commonwealth Club was founded in 1903, one of its founders, Edward F. Abrams of the San Francisco Chronicle, stated that the purpose of the organization as follows: "We only propose to find truth and turn it loose on the world." Tonight's panel, Microwave Radiation, the Shadow Side of the Wireless Revolution, is certainly in line with that mission. I am very grateful to our panelists for being here tonight, and without further ado, please welcome Camilla Reese, CEO of Wide Angle Health, who will moderate tonight's program.
Thank you very much, Dr. Grant. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to be here today to bring you leading scientific experts on the biological effects of microwave radiation. As some of you know, last August, a landmark report was published by a consortium of international scientists called the Bioinitiative Report. Over 2,000 existing research studies were reviewed to establish what exactly is known about the biological effects of radio frequency and extremely low frequency radiation. This analysis, available at bioinitiative.org, established beyond a shadow of a doubt that current exposure standards in the United States and many other countries do not protect public health. Earlier in the summer, another report was prepared on the potential health effects of citywide Wi-Fi in San Francisco, the conclusions of which are applicable to any city with Wi-Fi today or considering going Wi-Fi. I'm delighted to tell you that we have the authors of both of these scientific reports with us tonight, eager to share with you their significant expertise and policy recommendations. As you will hear, there are important changes that need to be made to reduce public exposures to information-carrying radio waves and to restore the rights of state and local governments to limit the proliferation of wireless on health and environmental grounds. If that is the will of the people, rights taken away in Section 704 of the Federal Telecommunications Act of 1996. Tonight's topic is a subject near and dear to my heart for two reasons. As the founder of Wide Angle Health, I am an advocate for patients' needs. I care deeply about whether our healthcare system is actually helping people get to the roots of their health challenges, helping people to thoroughly diagnose their, in other words, getting results. As you will hear from tonight, of all the possible root sources of imbalance, microwave radiation, an invisible stressor creating dysregulation in each of our bodies, is potentially one of the most important. Yet this subject is not even on the radar screen of most doctors who unfortunately are ill-equipped to either identify or help people being affected by these frequencies. An environmental assessment is not conducted before prescribing drug after drug after drug. This is a travesty. We spend over $2 trillion on health care, overlooking environmental factors in health, and especially overlooking electromagnetic frequencies, a type of environmental exposure that is not an isolated and discrete event that one can easily choose to walk away from. No doubt is significantly contributing to why almost 50% of Americans today have a chronic illness, a number that breaks my heart. The second reason I am passionate about bringing you this panel of experts tonight is that this subject affected my own health personally, and I am deeply in tune with the millions of Americans suffering today in every region of the country with similar symptoms. These are the people who are having difficulty working in office environments with wireless, who can't enter a public library or other public buildings with wireless, who can't focus well in a classroom, who can no longer ride public transportation because of other people using cell phones, who can't stay in hotels, and who can't go into department stores for long because of the wireless inventory tracking and security. And people, these are also the people who most certainly will no longer be able to travel on commercial airlines once the airlines industry plans to allow cell phones goes into effect. These are also the people who have lost equity in their homes because of close proximity to cell phone towers, and people who can no longer live in apartments for which they have signed leases because of wireless networks installed by neighbors over which they have no control. Tonight, it is important that as we learn about the science, we not just absorb it intellectually, but remember the problem, keep in mind the human toll, and remember that the problem is cumulative and progressive as long as wireless exposures in our environment continue to increase exponentially. In my own case, it began with headaches from my cell phone and an arthritic feeling in my hand, and went on to include focus problems, dizziness, clumsiness, difficulty getting the words out, disrupted sleep, increased isolation because I didn't want to be around people feeling so dazed, what I now call the zombie syndrome, and very, very low productivity. What would take me 1 hour to write today was taking me 5 hours or 10 hours or days. This happened in downtown San Francisco in the vicinity of 941 cell phone antennas in an apartment that had recently installed a wireless internet network and next door to a neighbor who had installed a wireless computer system on the other side of the wall from my bedroom. Just over a year later, that number of antennas within 1 mile of the location has grown from 941 mostly invisible antennas to over 1,300 today. I was shocked to learn other known health effects of wireless technologies go well beyond cognitive problems to include ringing in the ears, fatigue, depression, increased heart rate, immune system changes, changes in the blood-brain barrier, changes in cellular metabolism, disruption of hormone systems, DNA damage, dysregulation in the nervous system, cell proliferation, lowered sperm count, increased blood pressure, changes in the brain's electrical activity, and so on. As you will hear from today's panel, this is definitely one public health issue we do not want to put under the rug. As with many other technological advances throughout history, there are serious unintended consequences of these new communications technologies. A very, very disturbing picture is being painted of what long-term, low-level, chronic microwave radiation exposure is doing to challenge the health of humans as well as the planet. It is no longer a question of whether there is science substantiating harmful effects, as the industry would have you believe, but an emerging clinical health issue globally. We all have deep caring for humanity within us, and if there ever was an issue that can help us access that caring and express it, this is it. On that note, and without further ado, we'll begin. We'll have presentations from three scientists, and we will also have time at the end for questions. If there are any questions that we don't get to, we plan on preparing a post-event Q&A and which we will make available to you if you sign the book, the yellow pad at the exit. Our first speaker is Dr. Magda Havas. Dr. Havas is Associate Professor of Environmental and Resource Studies at Trent University, Canada, where she teaches and does research on the biological effects of radio frequency radiation, electromagnetic fields, dirty electricity, and ground current. She serves as an expert witness in matters dealing with electrical pollution in both Canada and the United States. Today, she will talk about the growth of the invisible electromagnetic frequencies in our environment, how we are exposed, and how we respond to these frequencies. Welcome, Dr. Havas.
Thank you, Camilla. Thank you very much to the Commonwealth Club for hosting this event, and thank you all for coming, attending this. I'm going to be talking about the adverse health effects of this energy, but initially I'm going to talk about why this is a problem, about a symptom called electrohypersensitivity that a very large percentage of Americans are experiencing, and also a little bit about the policy that varies from country to country. First question, what is the problem? The problem is that we have been using more and more electromagnetic devices. Ever since Edison invented the incandescent light bulb, we have had other forms of electromagnetic energy that we're using in our technology, from radios to radar to television. And you can see on this particular slide, let me just get my pointer working. On this particular slide, the radio, the radar, the television, we're all nicely spaced. As we go up on the scale, we have all sorts of things from compact fluorescent light bulbs that produce radio frequencies to Wi-Fi, WiMAX, smart meters in your home that's going to send the utility information about the wireless use of your electricity to radio frequency identification tags. With each one of these inventions, there have been adverse health effects. They range from cancers to electrocution to something known as radio wave sickness, which interestingly enough has a new name now, and that's electrohypersensitivity with very, very similar symptoms. In a very recent quote in The Ecologist in 2008, this is what Mark Anslow said. It is unregulated, untested, more dangerous than its proponents would have you believe, and soon to become even more powerful. What he's referring to is Wi-Fi, so that very many of us have the convenience of using computers in a park setting, for example. The real question is, what are the long-term health effects of some of this technology? We certainly know from scientific studies that there are short-term health effects that are documented within 10 years of exposure, and what is likely to happen if we continue to accelerate this form of energy. I teach a course on electromagnetic health effects, and when I'm introducing the subject to my students, we have to talk about the electromagnetic spectrum. These are the various frequencies that are used in various technologies, and they have different names, as you can see here, from radio frequency to radar to microwaves and extremely low frequency energy. One of the things that some people don't realize is that human beings are electromagnetic beings. Every physiological process in our body is mediated by electricity, internal electricity. The two most common examples of this is your heart rate. We know that we have a certain heart rate that's 1 to 2 hertz, 1 to 2 cycles per second, and that falls right here on the scale at the very low end. The other thing that we're familiar with is brainwave activity, and there are different frequencies that are called different things from alpha, beta, delta, theta, depending on the state of arousal that you're in, and that falls within this part of the frequency scale. When it comes to technological frequencies, there are three key areas that science has shown to have adverse effects. They include extremely low frequency at 50-60 cycles per second. That's the electricity that we use. They include power quality issues in the thousands of cycles per second. And they include microwave radiation, which is what we're primarily going to be focusing on. And that's in the megahertz and gigahertz range, so billions and millions and billions of cycles per second for the frequency. The effects for the electromagnetic spectrum include ionization above ultraviolet radiation and higher. We have an area where there are thermal effects, and that's indeed what most of our guidelines are based on, thermal effects, and then we have an area of non-thermal or biological effects. We're going to focus today primarily, but not exclusively, on microwave energy, and you can see here that it's very close to the thermal, non-thermal effects. We have excellent guidelines for thermal effects. That means that the guidelines will protect our body from getting heated. And that's what our government, the FCC, the Federal Communication Commission, and the Industry Canada in Canada deems to be the harmful effects. If it doesn't heat your body, it's assumed to be safe. This is not the case. We have absolutely no guidelines for biological effects. So you are not being protected by your government, and in Canada, we're not being protected by our government. And the reason, because we don't have any guidelines for biological effects, the Bioinitiative Report that Camilla referred to and that you'll hear more about later on is absolutely vital. When I teach about this in one of my courses, it's very hard to understand how microwaves function in real life. And light, visible light, is part of the electromagnetic spectrum. And a lot of the characteristics of invisible light refer to microwaves as well. It's really the same types of things. And we know that light can be transmitted through windows, for example. It can be reflected off of mirrors, it can be focused, it can be absorbed. Microwaves can do exactly the same thing. The types of things that reflect microwaves are metals. The types of things that absorb microwaves are water and fat. That's one of the reasons we can use a microwave oven to heat our food. If it doesn't have water or fat in it, it's not going to have an appropriate heating effect. Humans consist of not only water and fat, but very largely of water, fat, protein. Because metals can reflect, block, or focus radio frequencies, it really depends on where you are related to the frequency. If the energy is coming from one source and there's a metal object between you and that source, it can act as a block to the energy. However, if the source is coming from the other direction, it can actually increase your exposure to radio frequencies. So it's very, very critical for anyone who uses any kind of shielding technology to protect themselves to apply it appropriately with appropriate metering. Metal frames on windows can also concentrate radio frequencies or microwaves. And there have been examples of people who have become sick in their homes simply because that energy is reflected through the window. It bounces off metal picture frames, for example, and it gives very high readings in the middle of rooms. Fortunately, now there's technology, a fabric that you can get that will actually shield radio frequency radiation to a certain degree. And there's examples of this here. This happens to be a fabric that reflects radio frequencies, and people are using it to make curtains for their windows. They're putting it around their bed to protect themselves in the middle of the night. And we can talk about this a little bit more if anyone's interested. The other thing that's critical is that objects that you wear on your body, if they're made of metal, they can have the same effect. And that includes implants that you might have if you have artificial knees or hips, or if you have shrapnel, if you've been in the war. Then these are things that will heat up when you're in an electromagnetic environment, potentially causing localized problems. Very often, when the cell phone industry goes into a community and begins to discuss how safe the radiation is, they base that entirely on calculations. So they build up a tower, they put antennas on it, and they calculate how much you're going to be exposed. And that simply doesn't mesh anymore because there are all sorts of things that come into play with respect to exposure. The two types of exposure that most of us have to be concerned about is things that we generate within the home, and this includes any kind of wireless device. If you have a wireless router for your computer, for example, if you use a cordless phone, if you use your cell phone inside the home, you are going to be exposing your body to the microwave energy. The problem is if you happen to live near another home and you might not have any wireless devices, but they might have a cordless phone that's very powerful, you can actually be exposed simply because of their phone. And this is particularly a problem in high-rise apartment buildings or high-rise offices. The other type of exposure we're concerned about is something coming from outside with various types of antennas. antennas, from Wi-Fi antennas that are becoming very popular in the downtown core of large cities, to cell phone antennas, broadcast antennas, and radar. So if you happen to live near an airport or a military installation, then you could be exposed to that radar as well. Interestingly enough, people who work at the airport, the windows at the airport have special shielding to prevent them from having that microwave energy come into where your attendants are dealing with flight control, for example. Towers become vertical real estate for antennas. So as soon as you allow a tower to be built, chances are it might only have, you know, three antennas to begin with, and then eventually there's nine, and eventually there's 12. The tower is the physical structure that holds the antenna. There is no radio frequency generated by the tower. And as you can see on this apartment building, there's all sorts of antennas on top of this particular tower. The cell phone industry is already beginning to put them on high voltage transmission lines. And in this particular photograph, there are four antennas on these lines. One of the problems associated with this is that the wires on the transmission line act like antennas. So it's not only the antenna you have to be concerned about, you now have a wire coming from flowing where you have radio frequency actually being radiated away from the high voltage transmission lines. A very serious concern. The other concern is that if you have an antenna pointing towards a building, you're going to have reflection, even if it's not metal. It will reflect off of brick or concrete, and it will also reflect off the ground. So when you're actually doing measurements in the open, the instructions on any radio frequency meter will say, stand away from any kind of object so that you're getting it in free space as opposed to a reflection as well. One thing that few people realize is that this is not the way an antenna functions. An antenna actually looks something like this, almost like little lobes on top of it. And that's because you don't have a perfect antenna. And so you have these side lobes. And because of these side lobes, you can have very high frequencies immediately underneath the antenna, as well as some distance away where the radiation from the main beam is incident with the ground. This is why calculations alone are not enough to tell you what people are exposed to. In August of 2004, the International Association of Firefighters came up with Resolution 15, which was to limit cell phone installations on top of their buildings. They're very concerned about the health of firefighters. But this is what it normally looks like. There are all sorts of antennas going up. As Camilla mentioned, over 1,000 in the community where she lived. And this is what eventually leads to electrosmog. This is one study that was conducted in Spain of people who lived different distances from a cell phone antenna. In red here, you have those who lived within 10 meters or approximately 10 yards, all the way out to black, which is about 300 meters. And along this scale, you have the percentage of respondents experiencing symptoms very often. And these were the symptoms they experienced in order: fatigue, sleep disturbances, headaches, feelings of discomfort, difficulty concentrating, and the list goes on. Everything I have in red are the symptoms that we associate with aging. And so instead of calling this electrohypersensitivity, I actually call this rapid aging syndrome. And that's something I think a lot of people can identify with. So what we're experiencing is rapid aging syndrome, stress that's placed on the body prematurely. The World Health Organization held a conference on electrohypersensitivity back in 2004 in Prague, and this is their definition of it: a phenomenon where individuals experience adverse health effects while using or being in the vicinity of devices emanating electric, magnetic, or electromagnetic fields. Whatever its cause, EHS is a real and sometimes a debilitating problem for the affected persons. Their exposures are generally several orders of magnitude under the limits of internationally accepted standards. How many people are affected by this form of energy? According to studies in Sweden, it might be about 3% who have severe electrohypersensitivity. The most recent estimates are going up to about 8 to 10%. There's evidence from the United Kingdom that people have moderate symptoms. About 35% of them have moderate symptoms of electrohypersensitivity. And research that I've done in school environments with teachers suggests that it might be as high as 50% with mild sensitivity. If we then relate these numbers to California and the United States, we're talking about a million people in California, 10 million people in the United States with severe symptoms, and 10 million to 100 million with moderate symptoms. So we're talking about a very, very serious human health concern. If we look at the guidelines for radio frequency radiation, we have the ones for the United States. They vary between 2 and 1,000 depending on the frequency. And if you look at guidelines in other countries, and I'm going to leave the lowest one off of the scale, we have guidelines that range 5 orders of magnitude. For no environmental toxin do we have guidelines that range 5 orders of magnitude. Whether you're looking at lead or asbestos, and whether you're a person living in Sweden or the United States, you're going to have the same physiology. So this just doesn't make sense whatsoever. And if you look at the health effects, these are in red. Basically, the guidelines we have in the United States do not protect you against childhood leukemia, altered white blood cell count, impaired memory, and the list goes on. What needs to be done? We need to help those who have become ill, and there are 3 things that need to be done with them. We need to reduce their exposure, which means we need to know what they're exposed to. We need to strengthen their immune system, because this seems to be an immune system response, and we need to repair damage. We also need to prevent damage to others, and there's a lot of different groups that can help in this regard. We have an emerging global public health issue. The truth goes through 3 stages. First, it is ridiculed, then it is violently opposed, finally it is accepted as self-evident. And facts don't cease to exist because they are ignored. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Havas. Our next speaker is Cindy Sage. Cindy is an environmental consultant who has been involved in electromagnetic field issues for 25 years. She co-edited the Bioinitiative Report, a groundbreaking review of over 2,000 studies on EMF-RF factors in health. She also serves as co-facilitator of the Collaborative for Health and the Environment's EMF Working Group. Mrs. Sage is a highly regarded public policy expert and scientific consultant to architects, engineers, developers, governments, and industry on electromagnetic field issues. Let's give a warm welcome to Cindy Sage.
Good evening. Probably the most important number that you're going to see tonight is one you're going to calculate yourself while I'm talking. I want, for those of you that use a cell phone or a PDA like a BlackBerry or a Trio, without an earpiece, to think back about your use and calculate the number of hours you think you've used that device. Lifetime. All right? Doesn't matter what make or model. But toward the end of, middle to end of this talk, what I'm going to do is go over some of the numbers that we have today for estimates of malignant brain tumors that occur with exposure long-term to cell phones, and you might want to check your number. Tonight, I would like to acknowledge that we have three authors of the Bioinitiative Report. I am a co-editor. Dr. David Carpenter is a co-editor. Amy Sage in the audience is an author of a chapter with me and also was our research associate. And thank you to Nancy Evans, San Francisco, who is one of our reviewers. The Bioinitiative Report was prepared because so many people in so many hearings in so many countries around the world heard the words from industry, there is no evidence or there is no proof. And a group of us took it upon ourselves to create a document, and it's truly the only independent scientific and public health evaluation done to date internationally, to lay out the science which talks about what we know of health effects and bioeffects and health effects from electromagnetic fields. And in this report, which is a very large report, we cover power frequency fields from power lines and appliances, and we cover radio frequency microwave radiation. Hit the shift.
Like that?
Yeah, just
shift.
Yeah, enter. The arrows?
Oh, good. This group of experts that joined with us are all absolute luminaries from around the world. Every person, with the exception of one person, signed on and said, sure, I'll do this. I'll do this for free. I'll do this in 6 months. and I'll give you the very best of my product. We wanted the science out. We got it out. And very importantly, of these people, we had a few public health experts. So it's not just looking at the science and weighing it, but it's talking about the public health consequence as well. It is the informational content and not the heating, as you've heard from Dr. Havas, which is important. And it's the underlying reason why the standards that we have today for protection of public health from things like cell phones, cordless phones, Wi-Fi, WiMAX, and PDAs are not sufficiently protective of public health. They were designed for something different. They were designed in the old days. They are no longer sufficiently protective. And if there is one overriding finding from the Bioinitiative report, it is the existing international standards have no applicability to all these new and evolving technologies to which you've had a very good introduction. There may be no lower limit, which is safe. Every time we see a new technology roll out or deployed, we come to understand that for at least some percentages or some subpopulations, we have effects. So we don't know that there is a lower limit. If there is, we haven't found it. And we need to recognize that children are going to be most at risk. If adults are at risk, children in their developmental years, particularly neurologically, are going to be most at risk. And that is true of almost, well, probably, and David could tell you this better than I can, all environmental risks are worse for children because they're growing and they're developing. We had just, again, luminaries who worked with us on this report. They came from the United States, from Austria, from Sweden, from China. And we had David G. from Denmark, who is actually a highly placed policy person at the European Environmental Agency, which is the counterpart to our U.S. Environmental Protection Agency in this country. Okay, what did we find? In if you want one list, here is the list. DNA damage or genotoxicity, things which damage your DNA. And these are now all happening at levels that are lower, and in fact, sometimes thousands of times lower than our existing standards. The generation of stress proteins is a universal cry for help from the cell. When a cell is in trouble because of heavy metals or chemical exposures, or ELF, electromagnetic fields of both kinds we're going to talk about, the cell produces a cry for help. It's called a heat shock protein. It's an adaptive response. We reliably produce this now, or Martin Blank and Reba Goodman do, with exposures to very low-level electromagnetic fields. Cancer and neurological diseases are, to varying degrees, supported by the research we reviewed. Changes in brainwave activity occur within the first 2 minutes of a cell phone call if you're not using an earpiece. Changes in brainwave activity by themselves are just changes, but if you do this chronically, we don't know the result. It's probably not good. Impaired learning and impaired memory and impaired thinking function, cognitive function, are all hallmarks of exposure to microwave radiation from a cell phone or PDA. Impaired immune function in many ways has showed up, and we'll go over more of this evidence as we go through. Impaired fertility is a significant concern both for men and women, particularly people who wear these devices while they are on, and impaired sleep architecture. Now, sleep all by itself would be a big deal, because if you don't sleep well, your metabolism is off. If you go and you look at chronic diseases that have a root in disrupted sleep or impaired sleep, you will find among them diabetes, for example. Okay, so our conclusion following the first conclusion is the existing standards aren't any good for new technologies with chronic exposure. Our second conclusion is that we need new biologically based standards that reflect the science, that give us cushion on top so that it's not just that we're going down to the lowest level we see harm, but we're adding a safety factor, and these are biologically based. And why would we do this? Well, we would do this if we want to protect the integrity of the human genome. We've spent $3 billion or more to decode it. Don't you think we should protect it? We need biologically based exposure standards for the protection of immune and neurological function, for the protection of cognitive function and memory and learning, particularly in children. We need it to protect cellular communication, metabolism, and DNA repair, because you know DNA every day is damaged to some degree by normal metabolism, but it repairs to a great extent. But go and interfere with that process, and you shift the system toward continued mutation, and many of these mutations go on and eventually may form a cancer. We certainly need this for the cancer surveillance systems in our bodies and therefore protection. We certainly need it for the protection of normal fertility and reproduction of the species and of wildlife species. It's not just human that we're talking about. We need it to protect sleep and sleep architecture. We need it to protect against depression and fatigue and to protect against cardiac effects. One very great sleeper in this debate is whether or not we're looking at harm to the heart. We're talking about heart disease, and if we are, the numbers of people affected goes way up. Let's talk about brain tumors. In my opinion, the most significant findings of the Bioinitiative report are these. With 10 years of cell phone use, only 10 years, where the cell phone or cordless phone is used at the head predominantly on one side, and that's what ipsilateral use means if you read the papers. 10 years of use, cordless or cell, at the head, predominantly on one side of the head, is already showing significantly increased rates of brain tumors. These are malignant glioma brain tumors, and of acoustic neuromas. An acoustic neuroma is a tumor of the auditory nerve in the ear, and it's benign, but the surgeries are so severe that you wouldn't want to have one. I mean, this is not a place you want to go. Look at these numbers. We're seeing increases of 20% to 200% increased risk, and for cordless phones, we're seeing increases of 220% to 470%. Now, I've really encapsulated the work here. There are many studies, there are meta-analyses looking at all of the studies together. We're getting new studies in every month or so. We have an expert here in the audience, Lloyd Morgan, who knows more than anyone except maybe our Swedish people about these studies. But they are not showing no risk. They're not showing small risk. They're showing large risk, and they're showing it at only 10 years. Why is that important? Because if you expose people to ionizing radiation to create a brain tumor, the latency for a solid tumor is 15 or 20 years. We're seeing this in half the time. This is a very efficient carcinogen. Alzheimer's disease. If you read yesterday's USA Today, you know that one out of, 18 of us? Mm-hmm. I think it's almost one in four will develop Alzheimer's disease, which has horrendous psychological effects on families, physical effects on patients. It's a lethal disease. It's an expensive disease. It's the kind of thing that this society wants to get a cap on right away. What I don't understand is why we haven't heard from the Alzheimer's Society to say, oh, gee, well, it looks like exposure to something that's growing in popularity where there's no consumer information about this relationship would be an issue, because it's one possible risk factor for which we could do a lot. And we'll talk later in the Q&A about what you can do to reduce your exposures to these things in a measurable and significant way. But the risk of Alzheimer's disease with exposure to ELF is 200 to 400% higher where you have chronic ELF exposure. Now, the smart ones in the audience will say, ah, but my cell phone is a radio frequency device. Well, guess what? Every cell phone and every PDA kicks out ELF, electromagnetic fields, and the radio frequency comes on top of this, so it is absolutely an issue. Neurological effects are very well documented on learning and memory and so on. There is substantial evidence, and we're talking about hundreds of studies that you can look at that indicate neurologically, probably the central nervous system is the most impaired, the most impacted and impaired system in the body. And with chronic exposure, the bioeffects can reasonably be presumed to have adverse health effects. Neurological effects on children, of course, are unknown because we can't experiment on them, but if there are long-term effects, they will affect thinking, judgment, memory, learning, and control over behavior. ELF and RF are both genotoxic, and there's a lot of detail in this slide, but there, again, are hundreds of studies. More than half in every category show effect. For an environmental toxicant where you have more than half showing effect, highly significant. Not every study has to show it. There are large effects on the immune system and on immune function. The major biomarkers that we look to for effects on the immune function are present and are worrisome because of the direct relationship to inflammatory disease over time. And inflammatory disease, as David will tell you, is very expensive. Stress proteins we've covered. The bedrock for looking at cancers has been childhood leukemia. Childhood leukemia rates increase in the 2 to 5 milligauss range. We need new limits down at 1 milligauss or less. Breast cancer, there is substantial evidence, although not conclusive evidence yet, that exposure to ELF, EMF, or power frequency fields is a risk factor for breast cancer. Nancy Evans has been able to get this information into the brand new State of the Science on Breast Cancer document, which I understand Nancy has just published. Amy Sage and I wrote a chapter on therapeutic uses of EMF because EMF is actually used to treat diseases, bone healing, wound healing, pain management, and at levels that, guess what, are very low, meaning lower than the standards, meaning they work, and these are FDA-approved treatments. So it's sort of proof of concept in the reverse. It's the information content of EMF we are concerned about. It's not the heating. And again, our conclusions, the standards we have are inadequate. They should be replaced. They should be replaced with biologically based limits. And at this time, the proportionate response is to develop new standards and not to wait. We're beyond early warnings. We are beyond any reasonable definition of public health action being warranted, given the science that we have. And I'm going to skip these unless we have questions later about specifically about PDAs, blackberries and trios. They have the highest exposures we've ever measured, somewhere between 100 and 900 milligauss, and we have a couple of graphs that could be used to illustrate those points. Thank you very much.
Hey, thank you very much, Cindy Sage. Our next speaker is Dr. David Carpenter, who is a leading public health expert in the United States. He is professor of environmental health sciences and director of the Institute for Health and the Environment at the School of Public Health at the University of Albany, State University of New York. He was co-editor of the Bioinitiative Report. In the 80s, he was executive secretary of the New York Power Lines Project, a research study ordered by the New York State Public Service Commission, which confirmed a link between leukemia and elevated magnetic fields. Dr. Carpenter has served as an editorial advisor to cellular and molecular neurobiology and as a member of the editorial boards of the Journal of Public Health Management and Practice and the International Journal of Occupational Medicine and Environmental Health. He has published over 300 peer-reviewed studies and 4 books. Please welcome Dr. David Carpenter from New York.
Thank you, Camilla. My job is just to talk a little bit about what we should do from here on in. And I think that it should be clear to you from what we've heard that these fields do cause human health problems. We know that exposure to power line frequency fields results in an increase in leukemia. That evidence is strongest for children, but there's consistent evidence with adults. Now, I'm going to focus my talks on a few diseases which I think are the best documented, for which there's the least controversy, and use those as examples of why we need to have new standards. Now, we have this enormous expansion in the use of cell phones and wireless devices. And this is happening at a time when nobody talks about the hazard, when whole cities are going wireless without significant debate about whether that's going to ultimately be harmful, when schools are going wireless. And, of course, we want our kids to learn. We want everyone to have access to the Internet. But the debate must include what are the possible health hazards. Now, the other important point is the last one on here. We are all exposed to this stuff all of the time. And nobody asks you if you want to be exposed, but we are exposed because if you can turn on your radio, if you can turn on your TV, if your cell phone works, you're living in an environment of radio frequency radiation. If you can turn on the lights, you're in an environment with power line field frequencies. The question is it bad for you? Well, let's look at what the evidence shows. In most homes, without the appliances turned on, the field level is about 0.5 milligauss, milligauss being a unit of magnetic field. The evidence shows that there's an elevation in the rates of cancer in children, clearly shown if the field levels are 4 milligauss. And a lot of evidence that probably there's no threshold that even down to 1 or 2 milligauss there's an elevated risk of cancer in children. What are our standards? The FCC standards in the U.S. is 904 milligauss, two orders of magnitude above this, the level for which almost every investigator would agree has been documented to cause cancer in children. What are our exposures to wireless frequencies? Well, the background level, as shown there, is about 0.003 microwatts per centimeter squared. The evidence is less developed in terms of health effects from radio frequency fields. But as Cindy told you, the evidence coming out from the studies in Scandinavia show that if you use your cell phone on one side of your head for 10 years, very frequently, you have a significantly elevated risk of getting a brain cancer. What are our RF limits? Again, as Magda said earlier, those standards are set on the basis of what causes heating. I've heard that kids that climb up on top of cell phone towers and bungee jump find that the fillings in their teeth, if they have the old amalgam fillings, get hot. Well, that may not be the most dangerous from bungee jumping off a cell phone tower, but it does prove that heating does occur. Now, that standard is just way beyond the levels that people get by using their cell phone for 10 years. So the evidence indicates that the fields that we're exposed to, both the low-frequency fields and the radiation frequency fields that are common in our environment, are in the range that causes serious disease. This is a quote from the former Surgeon General that says, chronic diseases accounts for 7 to 10 deaths and 75 cents of every dollar spent on health care in the U.S. Well, cancer, brain cancer, is a chronic disease. And you've already heard about the variety of other diseases that have been associated with exposure to these frequencies. This is from Denmark. This just shows the increase in the use of cell phones, where now almost 70% of all males are using cell phones, a smaller percentage of all women. I'm sure the data in the U.S. is the same. What is so particularly of concern is that children spend hours on the cell phone. And no one is telling the children, look, this may lead to cancer in the future. And none of the parents seem to know this. Now, the evidence coming from Scandinavia is very strong. I don't mean to say that every study that's been done has documented this increase in brain cancer. There's a major study in a variety of European countries just coming out now and the conclusions that are already available are confirming the Swedish observations that if you use a cell phone too often for a long period of time, you increase your risk of brain cancer and acoustic neuroma. Well, what are we going to see in the future? Are we going to see an epidemic? We already have increases in leukemia, which is clearly associated with the power lines fields, probably also with the radio frequency fields. We also are seeing increases in brain cancer. These are the two most common cancers in children, and they're increasing in the adult population as well. Now, I don't mean to say that all of the increase necessarily is due to these fields, but there certainly is a good likelihood that some of it is. Now, children are more vulnerable than adults. They're more vulnerable because their bodies are developing. And, you know, sometimes we care more about our dog than we do about our kids. And we certainly usually care about our kids more than we care about ourselves. But if we can protect our children, we'll even protect our dogs. There's a study that shows that dogs get leukemia if they live in homes that have high magnetic fields. And if we can protect our children, we'll protect ourselves as well. But we must recognize that children are more vulnerable than adults. So the current standards are not adequate to protect anybody. And Cindy said this already. The standards that should be set should be based on the research evidence that we have. And they should be based on precaution. They should not be set at levels that we know to cause harm. They should be set at levels below that level that we know to cause harm. Now, there are great stories about what we didn't do about smoking and lung cancer. And what I like best is in a book that Deborah Davis recently published, demonstrating that the Nazis, of all people, had absolute definitive proof that smoking caused lung cancer. But people in the American Cancer Society and people at the Centers for Disease Control in the U.S., all of whom were smokers and all of whom had investment funds in cigarette companies, we didn't pay any attention to that, and we said, oh, it's just those bad Nazis, and therefore their science is no good. We lost 20 or 30 years and many, many people dying because we ignored that evidence and didn't do our own studies. I think the big danger here is that while we don't have all the T's crossed and the I's dotted, there is enough evidence such that we need to take precautionary action, and we need to do it right now. And we need to get our children off the cell phones. Let them talk on the phone, but use a landline. There's no exposure from that. And we are failing to learn from the lessons of the past. In the 50s and 60s, chemicals were the biggest thing in the going, and every new chemical was used without adequate testing. We're reaping all of the hazardous effects of those chemicals now. And we're finding for many of them that we blithely brought on the market and distributed around, that we can't get rid of them very rapidly, and so we're suffering from diseases from those. As we go through this wireless revolution that makes life easier for lots of people, we must put on the debate, what are the health hazards? And unfortunately, the diseases are not likely to appear until at least the very serious diseases, the life-threatening diseases, are ones that have a long latency. And we must not let that happen. Now, just a little bit of public health. EPA makes the assumption that for something that causes cancer, there's no threshold. That means if you can demonstrate a chemical causes cancer at some concentration, even at a very low concentration, it's going to cause cancer. It's just not going to cause as much cancer. That principle should be applied to electromagnetic fields, both the ELF and the RF. We have evidence that these cause cancer, and there is no reason to believe that any level is safe. Now, obviously, we can't avoid some exposure as we can't for many other compounds. EPA adds safety factors when children are concerned. And what I've told you is that at the levels of ELF and RF fields that we have ongoing right now, we're seeing elevations in disease. So we should be protecting our children, and we should have standards for children that are more stringent than those for adults. So preventive action is justified. In my judgment, the evidence for the power line frequencies and childhood leukemia is very, very strong, scientifically totally justified. The evidence on brain tumors and radiofrequency fields is growing. It's not as strong. It's certainly strong enough to take precautionary and preventive action. The many other signs of electrosensitivity that you've heard about, less well documented as double-blind studies, but the number of people affected seems to be very high. So we must do something to prevent these exposures. This is from the Rio Declaration, United Nations declaration that defined the precautionary principle, which says, in order to protect the environment, a precautionary approach shall be widely applied by states according to their capabilities. Where there are threats of serious or irreversible damage, lack of full scientific certainty shall not be used as a reason for postponing cost-effective measures to prevent environmental degradation. That applies to this issue. So what should we do? One can do nothing. One can practice some prudent avoidance of your own, and we'll give you some suggestions of what that can be done. Or we can have a major response with imposing limits. Well, you know, imposing strict limits is not going to be politically acceptable in the short term. But the observations are this, that there is an increased risk of cancer, and that those brain tumors occur in the side of the head that people use their cell phones. And so there has to be some caution in using these. We recommend standards that are basically right down at the levels where most of us are exposed every day. They're not really that tenfold below, because we recognize that that's simply not really realistic right now. But if we don't have standards, the industry has no motivation to develop the new technology that will allow us to still use a cell phone without developing a brain tumor. So this is why the Bioinitiative Report is so important. You know, it's interesting, we actually got criticized that we didn't have any government people on this report. It was all private people. And therefore, we didn't have the official party line that governments have. You know, we're not naive in thinking that we're going to stop using electricity, we're going to stop wireless communication. But we are calling for standards that would be set that would protect public health, that would provide a motivation for the industry to develop the technology that would allow us to have the benefits of the wireless revolution without having the hazards. So my plea is this. This isn't going to happen without citizens becoming concerned and demanding of their government that standards be set that protect our health. If you don't care about yourself and you don't care about your children, at least care about your dog, because the dog is vulnerable as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Carpenter. May I see a show of hands of how many of you would like to see your federal government's exposure standards for electromagnetic frequencies strengthened to reflect the current science? Thank you very much. May I see a show of hands if you want to see schools advised of the hazards of cell phone towers on their property and of the impact of wireless networks on the brain and on learning? Raise your hand. Keep them up if you want to see state and local governments be able to limit cell towers so local communities can protect their citizens' health. And finally, raise your hand high if you want to see physicians educated on electromagnetic factors in health so people will have a chance of getting well from the chronic illnesses that plague our country. Thank you. When I was a child, I sat regularly in a chapel by the shore in Rhode Island, where inscribed on the wooden walls were the words, "We are many as the waves, but one as the sea. In essentials, unity. In non-essentials, liberty." There is no question that this is a subject that can unify us, because we're talking about quality of life for everyone, about the DNA of everyone, and about restoring health to the planet for everyone. We the people, need to take back our rights to a healthy world. I'm so grateful to the Commonwealth Club and the Health and Medicine Forum and Environment and Natural Resources Forum here for supporting tonight's educational program, and also to our collaborators, Citizens for Health in Washington, D.C., and the American Academy of Environmental Medicine, who both immediately recognized the importance of getting this information out to the American people. If you are in a position to help make a difference through financial support or through your energy and commitment or through your organization, please let us know. There are many, many worthwhile groups out there working on the to change things at the federal level, to educate schools, to educate doctors, to train community-based environmental consultants to help people assess their environments to see if electromagnetic factors are happening. And finally, there are many brilliant research ideas out there worthy of your attention, linked to various diseases, and a pressing need for a medical conference on this topic for which there is need for corporate underwriting. Let us know if you can help. Sign up on the pads out front or contact us individually. Let's see. There's one more slide?
Yeah.
You can. These are the email addresses that might be worthwhile for you: whiteanglehealth@aol.com, emf@citizens.org, thebioinitiative.org, and info@theemrpolicy.org, which is the organization that is focused on change at the federal level. All deserve your attention and interest. So we'll take questions now. Any additional questions? Okay, great. What we're going to do is... Okay, so we'll have about 15 minutes for Q&A. If there are additional questions that we don't get to answer, we will make them available electronically. Put your name on the pad out front, and we will get answers to all questions out there. Okay. First question is, do you know of any organized effort to amend the portion of the Telecommunications Act that forbids consideration on health and environmental grounds when placing towers? Cindy? Or...
Well, there have been a couple of runs at the FCC to change the standards, but I do not know, although this is a learned audience, there may be someone here who does, that there is any congressional effort now to change the Telecom Act. It's one of our first recommendations in the Bioinitiative, however.
Mm-hmm. And the EMR Policy Institute in Vermont is working to address this. So their website, emrpolicy.org, is a very worthwhile one. Okay, the next question is, there are new federal bills to add to and extend EMFs into our homes, schools, and recreational areas, such as the smart electrical grid and wireless broadband. Please comment on the importance of this.
Well, you know, involuntary exposure to an environmental toxicant of any kind really ought to have big public debate, and we have absolute... media silence in this country on this debate, whether we're talking about wireless technologies or power frequency fields that are exposing us involuntarily. So at the root of the problem is an unregulated deployment of things that expose us involuntarily at many frequencies, overlapping with cumulative impacts to our health. And the number one thing I think that we need in this country is better media coverage, leading to congressional hearings, leading to congressional action and a mandate to change the standards.
Mm-hmm. Have any of you done research on the effects of microwave radiation on bees?
There is some research from Germany where they took what's known as a DECT phone, a DECT. This is one of the cordless phones that should be banned worldwide. It radiates radio frequencies, whether you're using it or not, 24/7. They took these DECT phones and placed them in beehives and found that the bees that were from that particular hive, many of them failed to return within about a 30-minute period. They also found that the weight of the beehive was much, much less. although there's a lot of things that could be affecting the bee population, from parasites to chemicals, there is evidence that for some reason they're being averted by these radio frequencies.
Is it true that liability insurers have stopped insuring cell phone manufacturers for health risks of phones?
Well, I think I remember that Lloyd's of London stopped insuring telecom carriers at one point. Lena or anyone?
That's what we understood.
Yeah. We just became aware that the Bioinitiative report is being read, all 650 pages, by one of the major U.S. insurance companies now to reevaluate their position on providing health care for people who smoke and who use cell phones.
That's great. I hear that EMF is affecting the efficacy of the breast cancer drug tamoxifen. Does this suggest that it's affecting the efficacy of other pharmaceuticals?
Well, absolutely, and in many different ways. It affects the uptake of drugs, the efficacy of drugs. It affects the way ventilators operate in hospitals and pain delivery apparatus and so on. So what we know about this is that there is a synergy of interaction between chemicals of many kinds in radio frequency and ELF, producing damage, and also for medications producing interactions. Mm-hmm. So for people taking tamoxifen for breast cancer, it may be partially inactivated. So all of its side effects you get, but all of its benefits you do not. And these are happening in environmental fields of 6 to 12 milligauss.
Mm-hmm. For Dr. Carpenter, MRI is a well-established method which indicates bioeffects from magnetic resonances. Why is the medical establishment so obstinate regarding the evidence of the bioeffects from a non-ionizing radiation?
Well, it's a very good question, because MRI is exposing both the patient, who usually has some reason to have an MRI, but also the technical staff to very high magnetic fields. And many of us have called for years for study of this population, particularly the technicians who operate the MRI machines. There have not been any studies, and it's true that the medical profession has been vehement in not wanting a study for reasons that I suspect are that they expect they might show something that would be harmful.
Mm-hmm. We also have anecdotal evidence from people who have become electrically sensitive. If they go in for an MRI scan, they have all sorts of adverse symptoms that last anywhere from a few hours to a few days, including being dazed, not being able to think clearly, having poor short-term memory. Some of them develop tremors that eventually go away. So there's a real problem with people who have developed sensitivity of actually having MRIs as a diagnostic technology.
Mm-hmm. Is there a connection between the rise in insulin resistance and EMF exposure?
We've done some research on diabetics, and this is an area that we didn't cover in today's panel discussion, and that's dealing with power quality issues. We found that if you're diabetic and you happen to be electrically sensitive at the same time, your blood sugar will spike if you're in an electromagnetically exposed environment. The spike comes within a matter of a few minutes, and it can be reversed in a matter of a few minutes as well. So within half an hour, your blood sugar will either go up or down depending on your exposure. We've worked with people who have type 1 diabetes where their environment has been cleaned up and the amount of insulin they require goes down substantially.
Are there radiation blockers such as pendants one can wear, stickers one can put on the cell phones, and beacons that supposedly block radiation to an entire home or piece of property truly effective?
No. In our experience, and we've been asked to test many things, exercise great caution, because the answer, other than a very specialized Lidovitz chip, is no.
Is it possible to isolate the symptoms and health effects of electromagnetic energy when we are also being exposed daily to toxins such as pesticides, percolate in water, hormones in food, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, that's a good question, because it's very difficult given that we all are exposed to so many things. But that's what those of us that try to study human disease try to separate out. controlling for the different exposures and looking for dose-response relations, which is to say we study those people with greater exposures compared to those with lesser exposure while controlling for as many other things as possible. But it's a good question, and it's very difficult to really control for all the possible bad things in our environment.
We have done experiments in schools and in homes where the only thing we've done is cleaned up the power quality, and we found substantial changes in health of teachers and behavior of students. Some of the symptoms that we now associate with attention deficit disorder were the symptoms that seemed to improve, particularly among elementary age children, where no other change has happened. We have other examples in schools where if they clean up the mold and the teachers go back after the summer, whether there are health changes or not. So there are some very select environments where we can actually do something where we only change one thing at a time to determine what the effect of that one thing is.
Are there reliable meters for measuring radio frequency?
Yes, there are a number of good meters. Probably you're in at least the $400 to $2,000 range. It's probably better to get someone to come in and measure for you because it is an art. It is a more complicated thing than measuring power frequency fields.
Mm-hmm. And we have a flyer out front on the table of a good source of the various meters available on the market, out on the table as you leave. What is more dangerous, the power, the power or the frequency of these devices, of cell phones, or both?
We know that different frequencies have different penetrating power, that they're absorbed differently in the body. There's evidence that frequency is important. There's evidence that the intensity of your exposure, the duration of your exposure, that it's primarily cumulative. There's evidence that even the waveform might be critical from a biological perspective. The other thing that seems to be important is the time window, depending on whether you're exposed during the middle of the night, for example, or during the day, what physiological state your body is in. So we have time windows, we have frequency windows, and we have intensity windows. So it's really a fairly complex type of exposure matrix that we have to look at, and that's one of the reasons I think that we need a little bit more research to fully understand what the mechanisms are and what the key exposure gradients are that we should be concerned about.
Are there any vitamins or natural substances that one can take to reduce EMF sensitivity, especially if one already suffers from occasional tremors due to electrical sensitivity?
One of the things when I deal with people who have become electrically sensitive, and I'm not a medical doctor, I'm a PhD, but one of the things that we tell them is they have to reduce their exposure. The other thing they have to do is build up their immune system. So anything that you can do to build up your immune system, and that means going to a good nutritionist, a good doctor who doesn't just peddle drugs, but actually looks at you as a human being, looking at you in a very holistic way and your environment. The other thing that you can do is actually repair some damage, and there's very limited evidence so far, but things like hyperbaric oxygen therapy might actually help recovery of some of your damage to your cells.
Bluetooth headsets are radiating about 1 milligauss. Are they safe?
Actually, they radiate at about a tenth of a watt power rather than a milligauss. But you're looking at another form of wireless exposure. And if you chronically wear it, if you keep a Bluetooth device in your ear all day long, as many people do for work, you're getting a whopping amount cumulatively of radio frequency. So what you really need to do is use a wired earpiece or use a Bluetooth-type device only when you really need it, but not chronically. Mm-hmm. And Camilla, I left one thing dangling, if I might.
Sure.
For those of you that actually did calculate the number of cumulative lifetime hours of cell phone or cordless phone use that you have without an earpiece, that number you can compare to this number, 260 cumulative lifetime hours is where we see the first spike in malignant brain tumors. At 457, we see another good increase. And by the time you have 2,000 lifetime hours, very significant increased risk. So you can keep that in mind.
This is an interesting question. How many people in this room have experienced adverse health effects from wireless emissions? Interesting. Is there any documentation on the role of either microwave radiation or electrical power transmission radiation reversing cancer remission? I'm a cancer patient in remission and was a cancer patient in remission was sent home. There are huge power lines over the property, and cancer came back very shortly after returning home.
There's been a study of children who had been treated for leukemia and those that lived in homes with elevated power line fields died more rapidly and their cancer recurred more rapidly. Mm-hmm. So I think the answer is clearly yes.
How do you know how many antennas are near your house?
There's a website that you can go to. It's www.antennasearch.com for the continental United States. And all you have to do is put in your home address or any address you're interested in, and it will tell you how many antennas are within very often an 8-mile radius. And it will tell you where they are, exact distances, who owns them, so you can get a lot of information on that.
It's a good suggestion. She's suggesting that maybe going to your local planning department might have more up-to-date information than the antennasearch.com database. I live within 300 feet of a cell phone tower and want to conduct an epidemiological survey of my neighborhood. Are there any resources to help me with this?
The EMRpolicy.org has a questionnaire that you can use. It's available free of charge for conducting a sort of unofficial survey in the immediate environment. And you can contact Janet Newton, and she can make that available to you. The only thing that they request is that you submit the results that you get so that they can have an ongoing database collecting something like this. The thing is, there's right ways of conducting epidemiological studies, and then there's wrong ways of conducting epidemiological studies, and this would just give you a rough indication as to whether or not there's changes after a cell tower comes into a community.
Okay, two more questions. Are we more vulnerable while sleeping?
Yeah, we all say yes.
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 Yes. One of the most important environments you should clean up if no other environment is your bedroom. And there's all sorts of evidence suggesting that you shouldn't use electric blankets unless you unplug them after you've finished warming up your bed, that you should keep clock radios away from your bed so they're not within arm's reach so you can hit the snooze button, that you not have deck phones or even cordless phones in your bedroom. And some of the things that are being marketed that I think do help is a power demand switch that you can put in your bedroom where when you flick the light switch, all the power goes off, so there's no electric field in the wiring in your bedroom.
And finally, what efforts have been made to the national media so they could publicize the bioinitiative report, and what's been the response to it in the EU and Germany?
Well, I can tell you that the the European Union countries immediately took up the bioinitiative in a serious way. The International Herald Tribune and the UK Independent and other major newspapers in every country of the EU had multiple publications. I do not know of a single publication in a major U.S. newspaper that has reported on the bioinitiative. So I would say that we need better coverage in this country.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll take additional questions by email for the next few days. If you want to email wideanglehealth@aol.com, any questions, follow-up questions, and we'll also answer all the questions that we didn't get to today. Thank you very much for coming.
Our thanks to Camila Reese for organizing this panel, and for the panelists Magda Havas, Cindy Sage, and David Carpenter for their comments today. We also thank our audiences here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 105th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.